Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. It is Sunday night, and that familiar slap of the bass means it's time for the weekend wrap. We all know, week three of the quarantine, everybody's staying in place, especially out here in California. I would imagine in New York, Texas, and even still Las Vegas. So we don't have a lot of current things to talk about, so we're going to kind of go down memory lane tonight. I got John Scully in here, who's always a great boxing historian. And then at the half-hour point, we're going to have Mr. Pat Russell and the champ, Lennon Brewster. And we're also going to go down a little memory lane with both of them. So we have some great minds tonight. Let's get this show on the road here. Start with Scully. I know Scully's up there on that East Coast where things are pretty tight. New York, Connecticut, New Jersey area. We heard Governor Cuomo talking about that particular area today. Not sure what happened there. Let's try again. So, as I was saying, we just heard Governor Cuomo today talking about the tri-state area. So we're going to try to see what's going on up there. Mr. Scully, how are we doing this evening?
Everything's good. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good out here in Cali, trying to stay away from people as much as possible. It's week three for us out here. I don't have any hair to pull out, so I kind of have to adjust to the situation as best as I can. But Scully, how are you guys doing? You're in one of those hotbeds over there, right? That whole tri-state area.
Yeah. Well, I've just I basically have not left the house for 3 weeks, other than to go to the grocery store, which is about 200 yards from my house. So that's it. I've been confined to this house pretty much for the whole time.
Yeah, I've been talking to a lot of guys. Now things are a little bit, it's going a little bit longer. I had Jake Smith on Tuesday. And he was telling me that, right about now, his wife and kids are, they don't know whether they're good to have daddy at home or what. They made him actually do his interview from another room. How are you finding, at home this much?
It is what it is. You gotta deal with it. My wife's been working from home, So we're here all the time. But I've actually over the last few days I've went outside and I've been doing quite a bit of yard work. So just trying to get some things done. Take it as an opportunity to get some things done that need to be done around the house.
Yeah, that's it. I think that's what all of us are doing now. Cutting grass and pulling weeds, and it's like,
hey,
there's no excuse now. I got to go over to the gym and talk. No, you don't have that excuse. But Scully, being the great boxing historian that you are, I want to go down memory lane a little bit, because I know you have to have some great memories, and I was just thinking of some names and associations that we haven't really talked to you about. I know that at some point in your career, you've either come across them or they've made some kind of impact. And one of the first guys, since you always talk to me, you always post something up or you've been to the different training camps, I was thinking of Angelo Dundee.
Right. Yeah, Angelo Dundee. I actually met him at the Hall of Fame, the Canastota Hall of Fame, International Boxing Hall of Fame, it was over 10 years ago, I guess. And I tell you a funny moment. Actually, I don't know if you've ever seen this picture, but it's online. It's floating around somewhere. But I was at the casino. I was at Foxwoods Casino back around, must have been 2009. And I saw Goody Petronelli, who, you know, I know very well because I've trained in their gym many times. You know, he trained Marvin Hagler. So I was talking to Goody down in the dressing room, and I said, you know, whatever. And so I went upstairs, and I ran into Angelo Dundee. And right away, I said, man, this is crazy. Like the trainers of Hagler and Leonard are here in the same building. So I asked Angelo Dundee. I said, man, I know it's kind of crazy, but – will you come with me downstairs to the dressing room? I want to show you something. I want to show you somebody. And he came with me, and we walked down and, walked in the dressing room, and there they were. And I didn't know if they knew each other or what. They were so excited to see each other, and everybody kind of gathered around, and Goody and Angelo just started talking, you know, talking about, you know, all kinds of stuff, and fighters and everything, and everybody was just kind of listening, standing there listening to their conversation. And I took a picture of them together, and I'm sure if somebody listening, if they Google it, I'm sure they could find it. I believe it was 2010 at Foxwoods Casino. So that was probably my best Angelo Dundee story.
Oh man, hey, okay. Let's go somewhere else here. Emmanuel Stewart.
I'll tell you what. Emmanuel Stewart, I was in a training camp with him when he was training Vladimir Klitschko. And I had a sparring. I had Matt Godfrey, who was a cruiserweight, and I was retired at the time. And I had Godfrey down there and sparring with Vladimir. And so I'm not going to name names, but there was a fighter there, an undefeated fighter of Emmanuel's who was in the training camp. And they needed sparring one day. They said they were going to be sparring. So I volunteered. Now, this is back in like 2009. And, my last fight was 2001. So they said, yeah, you want to box? I said, yeah, I'll work with them. So I put the gloves, put the headgear, and me and the kid, we did like, I think we did 6 rounds, and afterwards, Emmanuel Stewart was like so shocked, and he kept saying, this is, man, he said, we're going to get t-shirts made up, forget Klitschko. He said, this is the John Scully training camp from now on. And he was really happy with how I performed, and he actually, crazy thing, he talked to me after. Now, at the time, I was like 38 or 40, I think, and he said, based on what I see here today, he said, if you want to make a comeback, he said, we could do something. Like, I could work with you, and we could do this and that. And I was like, listen, I appreciate it. I felt good and everything, but I'm not ready to go back to this as a career. And he's like, well, all right, so but just keep it. If you ever want to, let me know. And so he was excited. He was happy, and my wife came down a few days later, and when he met her, and he started telling her the whole story, and she's like, no more fight for him. And so that was probably my best Emmanuel Stewart story.
Abel Sanchez.
Abel and I, we were out in California, I think it was. Man, I don't know where we were. We were in between northern and south, like the midway point, San Jose or somewhere. There was a fight. Actually, I was out there with Better Beav. This was about a year and a half ago. And so him and myself and Russ Amber. We would go out every night and go play pool, you know, and we wouldn't even really talk boxing. We would just go out and play pool at like midnight, you know, until like 2:30. And then afterwards we would go and we would go to like a Waffle House or something and hang out and eat. And it was a good dude, man. It was a real, real good. I asked him quite a bit about his training camp up in Big Bear. And he was telling me, you know, stories about Big Bear and Triple G and different things like that. But Abel's a good dude, a real down to earth, you know, real good dude, 100%.
Virgil Hunter.
Virgil Hunter. I'll tell you what, when Chad fought Andre, Andre Ward, you know, we were in the opposite camps together, and I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. Virgil's a very perceptive trainer, you know, and he reminds me of me in the regards of, it's not just about training fighters, but he pays attention to everything. And I noticed in the build up to that fight, he was, you know, he's the type of guy like me, like pay attention to what everybody says at in the training camp. I mean, in the press conferences and different things. And I remember reading an article before the fight, about a week before the fight, and he was given like his impressions of us and our training camp and different things. And I swear, and I told him after, I said, you know, I said, it was almost like you were in the camp with us. Like you had a spy in the camp with us. Like your perception, his perception was really, really right on. And so I have to say that he's got the mental aspects of boxing down very well. And I'll tell you another thing he did recently. I had an old amateur magazine with Andre on the cover. So I said, man, you know, somebody, I'm sure somebody would pay some money for this. And, you know, I could raise money for Wilfred Benitez. So I called Virgil and I said, you think I could mail you this and give it to Andre and have Andre sign it to this, you know, the highest bidder. And, you know, we could get some money for.
You seem to have dropped Scully there for a minute. Let's see if I can get him back. A lot of people on the internet now, so if we drop sometimes or something happens. I knew Scully would be the one that for us to talk to. Scully, I'm sure, is full of memories. Let's see. I think we've got him back.
Yeah, we got cut off.
Yeah.
How far did
we're
I get?
Back.
How far did I get in the story until I got cut off?
Let's see. Wow, I forgot who we were talking
Virgil
about.
Hunter.
Virgil, you were saying it was he had talked to you afterwards. You had said that you felt that he had eyes in your camp, and you told him how perceptive.
Right, right. Did I get to the magazine part?
Yeah, you got to the magazine part about where you you had called him and asked him you know, about having it signed, and that's about where you cut off right there.
Right. Yeah. Well. Anyway, so he did. He came through. I mailed it to him. He gave it to Andre. Andre signed it and mailed it to the highest bidder, and the guy got it. So Andre, you know, Virgil did me a good thing there, and with no problem, you know. So I definitely give him a shout out for that.
Barry Hunter.
I'll tell you what, I had a few years ago. I was at a fight, and you know, I had moved to Florida for a while, and a fighter I had worked with in Connecticut was down there, and I thought, you know, the guy that I was used to work with, you know, he had retired as far as I knew. He was well past his days, and somebody said he's fighting Anthony Peterson, you know, Barry's guy, and I'm like, nah, there's no way. And they say, yeah, he's going to be at the show you're at. And I get there, and sure enough, the guy I used to train was there. And, you know, like I say, well past his prime. And I went to Barry and I said, listen, I said, you got to do me a favor. I said, my guy, you know, I don't train him. You know, I'm not with him anymore. I didn't even know he's fighting. But I said, your guy is way too big, way too strong. I said, you gotta work with me here. Don't let Anthony hurt this guy. And so he called Anthony over and we talked and I said, look, I said, you know, you gotta go for the win, go for the damage, do whatever you gotta do. But just try and let's go for the body a little more than the head. You know, if you get him hurt, let's go to the body. And he did. That's exactly what happened. He knew. You know, he knew what I was getting at, and so they did me a little favor there by not going to the head so much.
Okay. Ronnie Shields.
Ronnie's a really good dude. I'll tell you what I told him. The first time I met Ronnie, like, you know, years ago, 10, 12 years ago, I met him, and we were in the dressing room, and he's there. I saw him, and Ronnie Shields said, I got to tell you what. I said, my father, when I was a kid, my father doesn't even know your name. To this day, he doesn't even know your name. I said, but he would always tell me, you got to jab like that guy, that kid from Texas. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 jabs at a time. Like the guy he reminds me of Willie Pep. And so I told Ronnie that, how my father said that he reminded him of Willie Pep the way he threw 5, 6, 7 jabs at a time. And so every time I see Ronnie, that's kind of our conversation. I bring that up to him. And real good dude, real quiet, humble, soft spoken type of guy, real professional guy.
Calvin Ford.
Wait a minute, hold on. Who was that?
Calvin Ford.
Calvin, I've never met him. To be honest. No, never been introduced yet.
Ernesto Rodriguez.
Never met him.
Let's see. I
can tell you about Andre Rozier.
Okay, yeah.
Andre Rozier, we, you know, trains Danny Jacobs and Curtis Stevens and all these different guys. But how I know Andre, we go way back to Lake Placid and Saratoga Springs at the Junior Olympics and the Silver Gloves back in the early 1990s and the mid-1990s. You know, we would be there with our teams, and our teams would box against each other. And I had kids, my kids fought his kids in the tournaments, and then they would all hang out together. So coming up in our region, you know, Andre and I were together quite a bit, and our teams were always together. So, you know, guys like Curtis Stevens, and Gary Stark, and Danny Jacobs, you know, I knew these guys I knew Curtis when he was 12, you know, because Andre would bring them to all these tournaments. So we, you know, whenever I see Andre now, the focal point of our conversation is asking each other how all these kids are doing. Kids from, you know, we're talking 1995, 1990, 20, over, well over 20 years ago. Just catching up on where those kids are now. So, you know, I was kind of appreciate that, him in particular, just because we both came up as amateur coaches first.
What about Coach Russell, Gary's dad?
I never really interacted with him very much, to be honest with you. I'm not even sure if I even met him.
Wow, I had somebody else right there on the tip of my tongue. This is not a trainer, but I'm sure you've had some interaction with Evander Holyfield.
I tell you a funny thing about Evander Holyfield, and it may be true, but I just said, what I had always heard, Evander Holyfield was, for fans, was tough to deal with, that he wouldn't sign autographs, he wouldn't take pictures, that he wasn't really friendly to fans. And so I had been around him numerous times, and I never even gave him a time of day, never thought of it. And so about I'd say about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I was in Las Vegas. We were at a fight. I forget. It was a big fight. I forget which fight it was. But we were at the food court at the MGM, and everybody was there. Like, Lehman was there. Rick Ball was there. Ray Mercer. I mean, everybody was near the food court. And so we're all, you know, everybody's hanging around talking, and the food court was packed. And I look over, and I see Evander in the middle of the food court just eating by himself, like, and nobody's bothering him whatsoever. And I'm looking around, and I say, either these people are scared to bother him, or they have no idea who he is, because he's just sitting there, no entourage or anything. So my first thought was, I'm not even going to bother with him. You know, he's not a friendly guy. That's what I heard. But I say, you know what? So I walk over, and I walk right up to his table, and I just said, I said, that Michael Grogan was tough to deal with, huh? And now most of you, I would assume the majority of people listening have no idea who Michael Grogan is. But Michael Grogan was a great, great, great amateur back in the 1980s, the early 80s, who beat, among others, he beat at 165, he beat Michael Nunn, he beat Virgil Hill, he beat Iran Barkley. But he also beat Evander Holyfield, and he beat Evander bad. He beat Evander so bad that in Evander's autobiography, he talks extensively about how Michael Grogan didn't just beat him, but actually made him cry during the fight. He said he was so frustrated because he couldn't hit Michael Grogan, and Michael Grogan was talking trash. And so I went up to him. I said, that Michael Grogan, he was tough to deal with, huh? And, you know, before he could say anything, I just sat down. And so he goes, yeah. And I figure he must have figured that anybody who knows who Michael Grogan is must be legit. So I just sat down. We started talking. And I never take selfies. But after we talked for like 10 minutes, and I say, all right. And I didn't want to give him a chance to say no. So I say, hey, let's get that selfie. And I put my arm around him, and I just snapped it. I didn't even give him a chance to say a word. And that's one of the pictures I've got in my files. Me and Evander doing a selfie that he may or may not have wanted to even do. So that's my Evander story.
So you bullied Evander.
Yeah, man. I didn't give him a chance. I gave him no opportunity to be negative whatsoever.
What about Eddie Futch? Did you ever get a chance to meet Eddie before he died?
No, I never did. My Marlon Starling, was trained by him, and my trainer at one time, Pepe Vasquez, was Marlon's assistant trainer, and he was, you know, in camp with Eddie, and they had obviously nothing but great things to say about him. Say he's a real, real gentleman, and just a very nice guy, and I remember Marlon saying. He said, Eddie is the only trainer he's had who knew more about boxing than he did. So he gave Eddie that level of respect.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I mean, a lot of these guys, you just don't, you just don't think of. But I know that you have that type of memory, John, that any of these guys you come across, you know, I can almost ask you, and you can tell me when, where, and how, and the whole nine yards. So I do appreciate
that. Oh, yeah, 100%.
Mr. Benavidev, you guys, I know everything is kind of on hold and whatnot, but everybody's doing Zoom meetings, and K-9 is talking about doing video classes and things like that. Are you guys keeping in touch like that? What are you doing, keep your amateur program alive and whatnot, doing this, no contact?
Well, what we did at our amateur gym in Hartford, we have a group text that we send out to all the kids. And basically give them, training regimens they can do. And we send out videos on Facebook to the group, just showing them drills they can do on their own, just to keep busy until it comes time to get back in the gym. But as far as articles, he's the type of guy, you don't have to tell him anything. As far as like a lot of guys, you have to tell them, you gotta stay in shape, you gotta stay sharp. But he's well beyond that. he does that all on his own. He doesn't need anyone to tell him to keep sharp.
What do you do? You know, I mean, what do you recommend that, you know, the fighters do? You know, like now, I had a young lady on the other day. She was just 2-0. Her career is just starting. You know, so not only does she not have that you know, much of experience, but she also lives in Minnesota. Cold as hell up there, so you know, there's not a lot of chance for her to get outside, but. But what do you recommend for, you know, those guys that or fighters, period, you know, that have just started and you know, need that motivation? I mean, that they don't, now they don't even have that paycheck coming in that they used to. So, you know, how do you keep that focus when you're the one that's, you know, really on, you know, right now you're on the bottom of the telephone pole? You know, we're going to have to come out swinging when things do pick up, so, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, at this point, I mean, the main thing I would tell any fighter in this situation is you've got to keep up with your running, you got to keep up with your shadow boxing, your jumping rope, your exercises, and, you know, if you have a heavy bag at your house, you know, those type of things. You know, you've got to keep yourself sharp. Like I say, I use Arthur as an example. I could use Bernard Hopkins as an example. Like, I'm quite sure if Bernard was fighting now during this episode, he would come out of this coronavirus period as in as good a shape pretty much as he went into it with. Like, he's not going to be home using it as an excuse to eat and get heavy and to get lazy. So, you know, if you're going to be a true professional and you really have those type of aspirations, then, you know, there's no way you should come out of this not still in very, very good condition. So that's what being a professional is all about. So to all the true professionals out there, I'm sure they're going to come out of this still sharp.
Can you give us an update on Wilfredo, you know, especially during this time? I know it has to be very hard on him and his sister as well.
Right. Yeah, you know, they're doing what they have to do to keep him safe, you know, keep him, you know, keep everybody away and keep all the germs away, you know, because in his physical condition, you know, it'd be a big risk, you know, for him to get it more so than most other people. So, you know, everybody's just kind of doing what they have to do. You know, the same thing with Gerald's sister, Lisa. You know, they're doing what they have to do to keep everybody secluded and safe.
All right. I know that the last I heard, they were had moved the New York Boxing Hall of Fame dinner back to September 20th. Have you heard anything new about that?
No, which one? The New York
Bob
State.
Duffy and those guys. Yeah,
right.
New York State.
I haven't heard anything about them, to be honest with you. This is my first. The main ones that I know about, you know, obviously is Canastota and the Ring 10 event, which is usually in September. Those are the ones, and Atlantic City Hall of Fame, which is getting postponed till I'm not sure when. But those are the three main ones that I go to.
Yeah, the Ring 10, is it, have they said anything about Ring 10 in September, to your knowledge?
Right, no, I haven't heard anything yet, nope.
Yeah, I intend to try to get up there for that particular event, too. So, all right, Scotty, well, hey, man, next week, let's find something else to talk about. Like you say, you're my historian here, man, and I know we can keep up stories for days. So, thank you so much for coming on, man. I got Pat Russell coming on next. So,
good. Tell him I said hello. It's a good guy right there.
Yeah, that's my man. So
I got
him.
Very
in my...
good guy.
So thanks.
Okay, good. Yeah, tell him I said hi. Thank you, and I'll see you guys next week.
All right, man.
All right.
That was the Iceman. Always good talking to the Iceman. Appreciate the Iceman. As I said, I'm sure we can go on and talk about things forever with the Iceman, and he'll remember each day and each event. It was really cool, kind of connecting his career with most of the events of today, including 9/11, the first day of the coronavirus, various incidents. So I'm going to grab Pat here before I grab Layman. It's been a while since I talked to Pat. As a lot of you know, Pat Russell is also a Vietnam veteran, and he does a lot of work out here in California, well, right here in San Diego, with incarcerated veterans. And I know that they, I believe the last time I talked to Pat, they were opening up a kitchen out here. We're going to ask him a little bit about that. And, of course, a lot of those projects now have been put on hold, but we can talk about their original intent and how you got involved, just different aspects. So this is one of the heads of the California State Commission here, Mr. Pat Russell. Pat, how are we doing this evening?
I'm doing great, Airborne. How are you?
Oh, man, hey, I'm like you. I'm locked down and, you know, house is secure. Like you said, you know, fire base came down here, so, you know, we're doing well.
Yeah. Isn't this a bizarre Easter? Happy Easter to all. I do believe that we will all rise someday, and this is a good metaphor for doing it, but what a horrible situation we're in.
Yeah, yeah, that we are. This kind of provides, you know, a little bit of a diversion from, you know, so like you said, some of the dire circumstances. Pat, some of the things that you were working on just, you know, before this that I guess we're just getting off the ground. The last time we talked, you had just opened up a kitchen here in San Diego for the veterans or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the last one is. I'm still involved with Veterans Court, and I'm still officiating, and I'm just having a great time. But, you know, like everybody else, I'm hunkered down on my fire base, hoping that we can figure out how to get out of this mess before it gets any worse.
Have you been able to keep in touch with some of your guys down there? You know, a lot of times, you know, when guys lose touch, they lose hope.
Oh, yeah. No, I think the boxing community is like everybody, you know, like every industry is pretty much gone to ground. And because we're such an intimate sport, you know, in a lot of ways, and, you know, when we're up close and in everybody's face, I think it's going to be a while before we figure out how to get back. And I don't know. I haven't really chatted with fighters lately. I know the officials, we've been doing a lot of Zoom in the air, talking to each other about situations and looking at films and, you know, trying to stay current so when the balloon goes up, we're ready to go. That's been kind of interesting because people have been jumping in quite a bit, and it's interesting to get different perspectives on looking at fights. And it's in some ways, I guess, it kind of sharpens your skill, although there's nothing like being ringside to really understand what just happened in front of you for 3 minutes.
Pat, we're joined here by another champion that I'm very glad to be associated with. And being out here in Southern California, I know during the latter part of his career, he was out here. So, Pat, Layman, Pat, how you doing? What's up, guys?
Hey, what's going on, man? How you doing?
How you doing, boss? Everything good?
Doing good. Yeah, man, doing good. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
Got to take care of each other. You know.
So did you guys ever cross paths in the ring?
I didn't hear the introduction. Pat, what was your last name?
Pat Russell.
Oh, I don't know. Did we ever? I'm trying to think.
You know, I'm trying to remember, and I honestly don't have a conscious memory of it. I guess I could go on BoxRec and find out, but I just don't remember us being in the ring. And I usually have a pretty good memory of the fellows that I was honored to have been in the ring with. Although I have been a fan of yours for a while, I just don't remember us being in the ring together. If so, I'd have to dig out into my obscure 71-year-old mind to find out.
Man, all right. Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, unofficially.
Oh, man, see, you never know who might be here, Layman, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah, you know. But it's, you know, both of you have had very storied careers. That's the reason why I was asking, you know, if you ever come across each other on a professional level. But, Pat, I think you did. Were you in the ring with Chris Bird?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, what is it, first cousins, Layman?
Second.
Second, okay.
Second cousins.
Yeah, I know Chris and I did a couple fights together, and back in the day, geez, that goes back a ways.
Well, you know, hey, Pat, you know, that's how things go. But, you know, as far as our memory, we can probably go back quite a ways. You know, we're kind of blessed here. Layman, when I was talking earlier with Scully and kind of going through your career, you know, the different referees that you were associated with. How were things when you came out here to fight in California? I've heard in some cases California was a lot tougher than guys thought as far as the health standards and that. And Pat, you know, since you're involved with that, were you one of the ones that helped, form for the California Athletic Board?
Well, I defer to the fighter first for his answer, and then I'll give you mine.
Okay. Layman?
What is your question?
I was asking, how did you find it when you were fighting out here? A lot of people say that California, you know, is a lot tougher on fighters than some of the other states, like say Texas or, you know, Vegas. You know, some of the other ones. What was your experience with the California State Board of Athletics?
I had no problems. Dean Lojas, as a matter of fact, was the commissioner. And, you know, like I said, I came to California as a kid, man, and I lived there for 20 years, and I moved away just 7 years ago, but I'm still L.A. at heart. But, you know, just to answer your question, no, I never had any trouble whatsoever with any of the officials. Melanie Lave was my, you know, she was like my amateur mom. And, you know, I had a great upbringing, if you will, from training at Mickey Rourke's gym, it was called Outlaw Boxing Gym on Santa Monica and Cole before Wildcard. But, you know, I trained at 108th and Broadway for like 14 years until I got in contention to fight for the title. So, you know, I never had any problem whatsoever with any of the officials in the state of California.
Yeah, Airborne, I think California prides itself on being professional and trying to do it. We have a tremendous system in terms of matchmaking. And for years, we were very blessed to have some of the great officials here. And that's why I kind of learned my trade from guys like Marty Denken and Larry Rosadilla, and Chuck Hassett, Jim Jenkin, Thomas. I mean, there was a ton of guys out here that, you know, there were just a wealth of experience. And it was a, you know, that was really a wonderful thing to learn. And in turn, what's happening now is I think Jack Reese and I are getting together, are going to put together a seminar on how to train referees going forward to do that. Because what happens is, and I'm sure Lance can talk to this, is a lot of what you're doing is making judgment calls on whether a fighter can continue. And all of that's relative and has to be put in perspective. And the more experience you get doing it, the more confidence you get doing it, the better it works for you. And we're seeing if we can pass on some of that knowledge to the next generation to keep the game going.
Well, hey, man, just to add to that, when I was coming up, Jack Reese used to come to my gym, and when I was spar, I would always allow him to come into the ring with me as an amateur and a pro. And you know, work on sharpening his craft. Now he's not because of me, but just because of his practice, he's become, you know, like yourself, a world renowned referee.
Thank you for that, boss. And that goes to prove, you know, something airborne. And I always believe that is that, you know, Muhammad Ali was right that the fight is never in the ring. It's always in the gym and on that road. And doing all that stuff ahead of time. That's true for officials, too. The ability to make the correct judgment, to take a young man, a young, very articulate man, like your other guest tonight, and be able to allow him to participate in a very dangerous business, and yet at the end of it come out and have his faculties together, and had a career, maybe continue in a different arena in the business, or go on to something else. That's a real art. And if you do it well, it's great. If it's not done well, boy, it's potentially disastrous. And that's just the downside of officiating in this.
Yeah, Marty Dean was a good friend of mine too, by the way.
Just so, he was a great guy and a real teacher and a. There's a lot of personal incidents with Marty, but he had a heart of gold. He was a tough businessman when he wanted to be, and he knew how to work the business. But he reached out, and he understood, and he lived the life, and he was willing to extend his hand to people that were living the life, too. And I miss him. I really do. He was a fine person to talk to about the business.
Do you remember Jackie McCoy?
Oh. and let me say this. I think he was one of the top five trainers of all time. I really do. And what I love about Jackie McCoy was he was a very, I don't want to say humble, but he was a very kind of a quiet man, didn't say a lot unless he had to say something. But, boy, nobody ever knew fighters better or ran a better tactical corner than Jackie when he was in the ring.
Yeah, did you ever used to go down to the gym that they had down in what was that? Was it Main Street? Was that called Main Street that they used to have, Jackie McCoy?
You know, I've been by Jackie's thing. I'm a San Diego kid, so it was always difficult for me to hit his gym.
Sure.
But I did go by and see Mr. McCoy several times. I think the time that I worked with Jackie was when he had Carlos Famoso Hernandez. Who won a title against somebody back in the 90s. And I think that was the last time that I'd had had an event with Jackie. And
he was a good, marvelous guy. Good guy. Yes,
he was, man.
Did you ever go to 108th and Broadway, Bill Slayton Gym?
No, another one that I missed. Unfortunately, a lot of the L.A. Boxing scene was something I just kind of got on late, and again I was out of town, so it was difficult to hit it. I hit the gyms in San Diego back in the day. There was only a couple, three down here, but they had a lot of fighters at the time, James Kinchin and the Norris brothers were working out of here. So we had a lot of business down here, and I had a job that, you know, kept me down in San Diego, unfortunately, going up there. So I was just kind of a visitor. But, man, that L.A. boxing scene, when it was on, what a scene that was. That was great.
Jack,
I'm sure, man.
When did you referee your very first fight, Pat?
Oh, 1980 or 81. I've forgotten one of them, but it was this starts my fifth decade this year. And it was at the – and I can tell you where it was at. I can tell you who I worked with. I don't remember the fighter, frankly. But I worked with Fritz Werner. Herbert J. Fritz Werner was a referee. Frank Rustich, a guy named Hal Rickards. And it was sponsored by Bobby DeFilippis and Pro Box, Inc. And it was at the Pacific Palisades Skating Arena on El Cajon Boulevard in San Diego.
Wow!
Did you remember a heavyweight named Levi Billups out of San Diego?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And a tough guy he was too. Levi was a good fighter.
Yeah, man. Did you ever? Oh, so you never got to make it to the fights when they used to have the fights at the Forum?
Oh yeah, no. I worked the Forum for a long, long time. And that was another great venue. And Airborne, I'm telling you, I don't know if you were in California, if you were there at the time, but boy, I'll tell you what, Monday night, fight night at the Forum, they had some great announcers, including Chick Hearn, actually. And boy, they had more champions. It was a house of upsets. And I think one of the great title fights that I had the honor of working at that point was Marco Antonio Barrera versus Kennedy McKinney back in the 90s. I think mid-90s is when one of the last Forum fights I did.
Nice. Yeah, man. You know, it was an amazing time to come up in the 90s with so many great fighters coming out of, you know, that Los Angeles, San Diego era. And, you know, I remember everybody that you name, man. It was just an incredible time. And I know we spoke about Chris Bird, and I was telling him about all the sparring that I was getting coming up as a professional, and he just couldn't believe it because, you know, any given day, man, it was the likes of people like James Toney and Michael Moore and Francois Botha and Jeremy Williams and Frankie Lyles. The list just goes on and on and on, man. So it was like, you know, it was really a great time for boxing. And, you know, to me, boxing, well, we all know, you know, boxing, the face of boxing has changed. You know, I think now it's more about social media and what you wear into the ring versus how well you can really, really fight, you know, skill-wise. But, you know, nevertheless, man, you know, and then, you know, to say, you know, we never lived in a time where you got guys 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", that are just as agile as a guy 6 foot. You know, this guy in the heavyweight division is so huge now. Like, I couldn't imagine a guy like George Foreman in his prime, he was like 225 and he was considered a big heavyweight. Whereas today you got guys that would make George Foreman look like a toothpick that's just as agile as George Foreman was at 225, but they're every bit of 270, you know, and 6'9". It's incredible.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree. And that's, I think, a really good analysis of where we are now. And we've had some terrific fights. I mean, those fights between Wilder and Fury are really, well, especially the first fight, were just an amazing thing to watch. And you know, and you're right, these guys are just enormous. But I think that's in all sports. I was looking at just, you know, the potential NFL draft, and they were talking about defensive linemen, and I don't think I saw one that was less than 6'5" and less than 300 pounds, which to me is, you know, like a giant. I mean, I'm like 5'7", maybe 185, 190 pounds, and you know, looking up at a guy like that would be like looking up at you know, at a giant, out of a movie or something. It's just amazing to me how big we've gotten and how we've, you know, changed the sport just based on the physical domination of bigger men.
Pat, can I ask you, where were you the night that Lehman knocked out Vladimir?
Did I lose you, Airborne?
Yeah, I was saying, where were you the night that Lehman knocked out Vladimir?
Oh. You know, I'm trying to remember, but I do remember that fight. And boy, I'm trying to think. I'm sure it was at some friend's house, eating ribs and getting excited. Wow, what a great fight that was. What was about that fight?
Chad, did you say something?
No, I didn't say anything.
Hoping you tell us about your thoughts on that fight.
Oh, what's that? The Vladimir fight?
Yeah, the ones, yeah. You know.
Well, you know, it was just another night in the office, so to speak, just where a fighter that had a game plan, he came in there and, you know, the better man prevailed. You know, Vladimir he's a very good fighter. He's a terrific fighter. And it was a fight where I knew that he lacked stamina, but I would have to push him to his limits and make him get tired and then try to fight him when we're both tired based on heart. And, you know, watching fights like Davey Boy Moore, Default, Roberto Duran, and a whole lot of Joe Frazier and Julio Cesar Chavez fights, just where it's not about winning rounds, but about putting pressure, applying pressure, and making a guy punch when he didn't want to punch, and make him hold when he didn't want to hold. And you know, psychologically, I was able to break him down by making him punch himself out because he couldn't swim out in the deep water.
Wow. Was that a game plan? Had you planned on doing that ahead of time? Had you done your homework and you knew that that's where it was going to be and withstand the assault at the beginning?
Yeah, well, it was a fight plan that I put together for the whole duration of the camp. Well, it didn't make sense to go in there at 6'2", trying to box a guy that is 6'7", and can hit you from the other side of the ring, regardless of my skill level. So I knew that he had a stamina problem. But, you know, again, he's a big puncher. So what my plan was to make him punch and punch every second of every round. And if he can escape by punching every second of every round to the last bell, the 12th round, well, then he would have won that fight. But I knew that he wasn't going to make it that far because I had an axe in my hand and he was a tree.
Boy, I sure hope this virus business goes away. I miss boxing. I really do.
Speaking of missing boxing, guys, Pat, you mentioned it, you know, early on, this is a game that's up close and personal. How do you think, you know, training habits are going to change? I think it's going to be a while before even fighters, you know, I'm not going to necessarily use the word trust, but you want to be safe and you want your family to be safe. So do you think that this is going to have a lasting impact as far as the way we train fighters and the way we interact with our fighters, especially, well, first of all, I'm going to go to you first, Pat, especially as a referee, when you're the one that's up close, you know, the sweaty bodies, saliva, blood, whatever. What are you thinking?
Well, on a personal level, I don't think you can just take a microcosm of boxing. I think that what this has shown us is that we're going to have to change our way of thinking and our way of doing business. You know, right now, they have a lot of testable diseases. You know, typhus and whatever else, and you can find out about those diseases when you test for them. But the problem is we don't have a test for this. And the other problem is that a person who is, you know, is asymptomatic is the kind of person that can give that to you. We don't know the gestation period, et cetera. I do not believe that this is going to be the only thing out there. I think we're going to have to change our entire way of doing business. We're going to have a Department of Health in this society, which takes a look at this as a 724 basis, so we don't get caught flat-footed like we've been caught this time, to have to deal with this society dispersal. But I think once we do get a handle on this, and once we can get a vaccine for this, and then more appropriately, if we can test for this and find out if it's going to be an issue, and then I think at least you will have some knowledge going into the ring. But, you know, it seems to me that the old ways of doing business in terms of this country and our hierarchy of thinking about it is just going to have to change. That's a personal opinion.
Layman, how do you feel about the different state boxing commissions, having different rules? Do you think that this is going to be something where we have to be a united front? We can't change the rules from New York to Texas or from Texas to California. This is something that we all have to be concerned about. So do you think that this is going to have an effect on the boxer and where he fights?
Absolutely. And go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I absolutely believe that things have to change because the times call for it. Boxing has needed a facelift, so to speak. Sometimes in life, a setback is a setup and set up for greater things. And I think it's going to make boxing do something that it should have been. This should have been done long time ago, which is remodel, if you will. For instance, when you used to go into an Apple store back in the 90s, you had all these big clunky computer tops on the counters for sale. But as time has went on, now when you go in there, it just looks like a bunch of tables because they got little bitty things sitting on the table because times have changed. And in order for boxing to progress, if you will, we have to come together on a united front because together we stand, divided we fall. But the beautiful thing about it is that this is going to really, really put the spotlight on the greedy promoters, the unfair various commissions in certain states that we know have not always been fair to people that are coming from other cities. So I think all the way around that this is a good thing. Even though it's bad, I think it calls for ingenuity. It calls for people to dig deep to try to find out a way to still be able to be entertained and to draw people to your specific entertainment, though I think it's all going to be more digital versus being where you're going to have the large crowds. I truly believe in my heart that the time for the large crowds are all the way done away with, and I believe that we have to start looking at a future where it's more of a televised-based promotion company versus an audience, so to speak, just for health reasons, because we're entering into new times, and it'll never, ever go back the same. No, there'll never be a time when a man will say, oh, yes, I want to take my son to a fight. Well, yeah, he may want to, but he's not going to risk the life of his son or his to go to a fight, but he would be willing to watch it on television. So, again, I think it comes down to smaller amount of fights and more live, more interaction, more interviews, more things to fill in the gaps of the crowds, I believe, versus it being a crowd of people, I believe there should be a panel of champions that may be via satellite that are commentating on the fights, just to give it a new look. I mean, you have to. If you don't, because the thing is, boxing has stayed, it has remained still in the same place forever, and we need upgrades, and it's not always necessarily because you create new rules. I mean, you need more things like social media and things like that to play a bigger part, and especially if you want to get these sponsors involved and keep the love and interest of what this sport has to offer. That's my take on it.
And it's a great take, champ. I agree with you. I think the first and foremost thing that needs to happen is, and it's been talked about for, I don't know, ever since I can remember in this business, is there probably needs to be a national commission that regulates and has the standards and training and safety issues that are nationwide and has a base of competency in enforcing and creating that environment that's safe. And then I think, frankly, we're going to be in a whole new era, and I agree with the champ on this, a whole new era moving forward as to how we're actually going to view live sporting events. And, you know, I'm a baseball fan as well as a boxing fan, and, you know, I don't know how I'm going to feel going to a ballpark now. Part of that was, you know, the smell of the grass and the hot dog in the hand and the, you know, talking to my other season ticket holder guy about how our team's doing. All of that is probably going to be modified and certainly changed if it's not, you know, if we do come back together to get it done. And I think, frankly, that the idea that somehow we're going to go back to where we were the day before we did the shutdown is naive and doesn't look to what the future is. I agree with the champ. I think there's going to be a lot of changes.
Look, here's the thing, guys. I understand it's going to be a lot of changes for the fans. Okay, you know, are you going to trust the person beside you, this, that, and the other? But the guys that are actually participating in the sport, how are you going to play a football game 6 feet apart? I mean, you know, what do you
exactly.
Do? Everybody shoots the basketball from half court. Everybody's not a Steph Curry. I mean, you know, so how do you fight? How do you train? Do you fight with a mask on? You know, are we going to fight with respirators? What's the referee going to do? Is he going to have oxygen on his back? You know, how far away do we sit? You know, I mean, you know, how far does the blood spray? Come on,
well,
guys. What about the participants?
Well, you know, that I'm going to say this, man. Right now, it's too soon to make any real predictions because we'll just basically be shooting in the dark because we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring about. Right now, I know the last thing we should ever be thinking about doing is thinking about everything going back to the way that it used to be. It'll never be the same in any sport worldwide because of the fact that even if you get all these athletes on the field, like when you made reference to football, to basketball, you still got to worry about the fans at the end of the day. And without the fans, you can't have any of these sports. So what we have to do is come together to try to figure out what would be the best antidote to be able to make the fans feel safe at the end of the day. And that's what it comes down to, safety. I mean, you know, a warrior is a warrior, whether he plays baseball, basketball, football, boxing, soccer, it don't matter. We're going to do what we got to do to win. That's why we take the HIV test before we get in the ring. We take all the blood tests. We take all the physicals. Warriors going to do what warriors do. But it's not the warriors we got to worry about. It's the fans. And when the fans feel comfortable, then, you know, like they say, if you build it, they will come. But in this case, we can't just build it. We got to build it with safety measures in mind and then we can think about being successful.
Pat, it's been three weeks. Have you, the California Commission, you guys been reached out to from any other organizations about, you know, what's possibly going to be happening afterwards? Is it just the time to talk?
Well, again, I'm gonna defer to what I thought was a really spot on commentary by Champ. I don't think anybody knows. I think we're all in the dark at this point, trying to figure out what the next day is going to be, much less a long-term game plan. If you go back and look at history, there were all kinds of diseases that we eventually got beyond. But we've never gotten past respiratory illnesses that morph and turn into different things based upon different times. Yeah, we've got the flu, which is a consistent, it's out there, but we have in theory some way to take care of it. If we come up with a vaccine for this, I mean, just on the practical level, if you're running a gym and Champ comes in and he wants to spar, he's got a title fight coming up, he wants to do four or five sparring partners, he takes his test, he checks himself and makes sure he doesn't have the disease or he's got the antibodies and he's got the inoculation. Well, what about his sparring partners? Do you have to run a medical check on every one of them before you get them in the ring? And how does that work in terms of the trainers? Do they have to take it? What about all the guys that hang out in the gyms and stuff? It's just going to be different. And I'm just, you can either change or you can become extinct. And I think we're going to have to change and fit the circumstances coming down as it comes down.
I totally
Go ahead, Lane.
I was just going to say, I totally agree with that. What your last statement was that, I was thinking when you as you were speaking, I was like, it's in order to roll the dice, we first have to have a table, because the table we had, it got burnt up. it was like, we got to get rid of this table. We need a new table. So we need new ideas, new rules, new guidelines, and that's just going to take time, because there are so many things that must fall into place, because you have to worry about the fans, not only one another, but infecting the athletes and vice versa. So, right now, I mean, it's really just the time to be really thinking about and coming up with all these different scenarios of how we can move forward with this sport. But at the end of the day, I know that all things work together for good. So all this setback does is it makes a hurdle for us to leap, to show us that we have, I'm sure there are some people out there, even myself, I have a lot of already been working on great ideas that I know can help this sport to continue and actually take it to an even higher level and appreciation. But that's those things are going to come out in time, man. I mean, right now people are still dying. There are cities that still hasn't even caught the epidemic. There are still people who don't really understand the seriousness of this thing yet. So what we got to do really is people have to first wake up. I mean, the whole country, not just what you hear on the news, you have to actually get with your communities and start trying to figure out ways to head this thing off, really, is what I'm trying to say. And then we can really think about, once we get a little more control, we don't have any control, but once we can get control of this thing, that's going to pretty much dictate the pace that we're going to move, as well as the direction that we're going to move. So for me, it's very difficult to sit and say, oh, yes, well, when this is over, because over may be a year from now, over may be 5 years from now, over may be never. So like, for me, it's just like, okay, well, I'm saying to myself, what can I do to give back to the sport that gave me a reason to live, that gave me a better life? And so what I'm thinking in my mind is how can this thing function without the fans being live? So I think my mind is telling me that you're going to see a lot of pay-per-view, if you will, mediocre pay-per-view channels, which is actually going to give the promoters and these retired fighters a chance to come together to intermarriage, so to speak, because the last thing that a retired fighter ever wants to do is be forgotten. But at the same time, all you always got small-time promoters that want to be big-time promoters. So I think the marriage between the two on top of the television or the internet is going to be the way to go with small fees, because less is more, instead of trying to tax people. You know, it's what you're going to be bringing to these local shows, because you're going to have local promoters way more than you're going to have the big fights. The big fights will resume, I'm sure of that. But it's the local fighters with the local promoters that are going to have the most trouble, because local promoters, as you know, only generate money when they can get butts in the seat. Being that we know that the greatest fear is being close to someone could lead to your death, that really puts the knife in their heart, in terms of their financial success in the future. So what we got to be doing, what all of us have to be doing, especially these promoters, thinking about ways that they can protect everybody so that they can continue on in the direction of success that they're trying to achieve.
Pat, I'm going to let you go in a couple of seconds, but one of the final things I have to ask is, we went through quite a transition here in San Diego as far as the boxing fans and as far as boxing shows. We still have great fighters train here in San Diego, but we don't have a lot of shows here in San Diego, and it seems like some of the local promoters had kind of lost a taste for putting on shows. So what do you think that this is going to mean to our local circuit here in San Diego?
Well, for the probably the 80s and the 90s, I think the really biggest promoter in town was Bobby DeFilippis and his pro boxing. And Bobby had a good crew, and he put together some really great shows. But the problem with San Diego, like any place, is to get the venue. You've got to have a venue that fans are comfortable at, that they can come to, that's not going to cost you an arm and a leg. And if you can do that, especially for smaller club shows, if there is such a thing, then it would probably come back, because there are great fighters down here. What Bobby has done is he does a lot of promotion now down in Tijuana. And the reason for that is, the venues are there. You can get a Palenque down in Mexico that'll seat 1,000 people. It's in a straight up and down venue looking into the ring. And, you know, people are going to come, and you can afford it, and they're going to come to that venue. So I don't know the answer to that. What I do see, though, and it'll be interesting, is that I've just seen a ton of boxing gyms come up. And I don't know if it's, if it's yuppie boxing or people just getting in shape or whatever. But out of that is going to come kids who want to fight, who are good at it, who know what they're doing. I think, females in the last 20 years that I've been noticing have really come from zero up to, some really excellent fighters that know the skill levels involved, picking punches and throwing them. And I mean, they're just terrific boxers and fighters. So, I just feel like right now, for me, I'm in this kind of holding pattern until I see how the whole thing plays out in front of me. What Jack and I are going to do is that we're going to put on this seminar to at least get the basic skills for referees, that when they walk in there, that person is going to be competent and he can safely arbitrate that bout. And we think that's where we can make our contribution, especially in my case, because I'm retired from the ring, towards the younger generation. And then whatever happens after that is going to be in the hands of God and fate, and that's, we'll just go from there.
Last question, Pat. it always kind of, as a fan, it drives me insane. Because I don't know what... it's kind of like the Olympics almost. I don't know what's a punch and what's not a punch. And it's like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. Are we going to get, is there any way that we can either, let's put it like this. Do you think that there's a future for PunchStat in the modern streaming world?
Well, I'm probably like you, Airborne. I'm not a big fan of statistics ever since my service in Vietnam, because what you realize is there's little lies, bigger lies, and statistical lies. And what we're really saying is, to me, people talk about effective punching. I always reverse that and say the punch had what effect. A big man like the champ hits me, he's only going to have to hit me once or twice. He's going to knock me out. So, all the punches that I throw like a mosquito, trying to do something in return really don't mean anything. So the value of the punches is what I'm saying. The value of what is caused by that punch, the effect of that punch, is what I look at as a judge. And statistically, I just kind of ignore it. And I think most fans do too, frankly. I mean, if you sit there and say, other than, if you could count the punches and say that these guys were averaging throwing 200 punches around, well, then they're telling you something. That tells you the intensity level of that fight. But what those punches, what effect they had, I think that's in the hands of people who make judgments at ringside.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Well, thanks so much, Pat. Enjoyed talking with you, man, and hey, man, I can't wait for the chicken pie shop, man. I'm missing my pie here, man. What's going on?
I am too, brother, and we'll get back and do it. And, Champ, nice talking to you, and I hope we get a chance to meet in person.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it as well, man. Thank you. It was a great conversation.
So much, bro. Have a great Easter.
Sir.
All right, you too, Pat. Layman, man, look. As I said, everywhere I go, I hear nothing but accolades about you, man. I had, for those of you that didn't listen to my political show Friday, we had a father on there that lost his son to brain cancer, and we were talking about a connection between boxing, his son, Angel Man Freddie. And there's a conference call with you, Champ. So, every week, as I've told you before, and I want the fans to know that you might be retired from the ring, but you're still in the fight, not only for the education of our youngsters, not only for the discipline and the mentorship that you bring to our youth, but for someone that is willing to walk the walk, not just inside the ring, but now outside of the ring also. You have great organizations like Brewster's Place, and you always think of the downtrodden and those that are more or less kind of dispossessed by society. You've done work, hurricane work, as well as I mentioned before, Brewster's Place. Tell us, Champ, where do you get this drive and determination from?
To answer your question, man, is just who I am, according to my spirit. I've always been driven by my spirit to strive for something that I'm led inside to do. I use a lot of philosophies in my life, man. And one of my philosophers, Frederick Douglass, he said, knowledge makes a man unfit to be a slave. And what I'm speaking of is that we
as human beings are trapped in certain boxes in life because of our understanding or our lack of understanding, if you will. And so what I've tried to do was just free my mind of all the things that I felt I had gray areas in. And for me, learning this sport, I grew up in this sport since 1980. I'm 46 now. I started at the age of 7, and I've lived in the boxing gym. I've lived on watching fights, man. I've been a fighter. I've been a trainer. I've been a manager. I've been a promoter. Boxing is my way of life. Boxing has afforded me the things in life that people could only dream of because I gave my all to it. So it really wouldn't make sense from the standpoint of trying to do anything else because I have my PhD in boxing. And so what I am trying to do is accomplish the things that will not only keep the sport going, but to help the sport to grow and help it to go in a positive direction. And that requires saying things that need to be said, doing things that need to be done. And that's what I try to do, man. I just try to apply myself. I think of myself as a servant of God, and to see another young man have the opportunity to leave his confines, whether he be in a ghetto or whether he be in you know, the suburbs, it doesn't even matter. The fact is that if he has a goal and dream of trying to be a champion or be a trainer or be whatever it is in this sport, then I want to try to do my best to help that person, because him or her. Why? Because here's the thing, man. In life, people try to tell you what you can do or what you should do, you know, because it was safe for them. You know, people who are afraid to take chances in life, people who are afraid to lose, always got something safe to say. But ain't nothing safe ever been about peace. Like, people always say to me, peace, peace, peace. Well, what are you willing to fight for? Like, why do you say peace to me? Because you cannot have peace without having war. And I catch myself because I'm so rebellious. Like, when people say, hey, peace, man, I'd be like, war. Because if you want peace, you got to have war. And war is something as simple as getting up every day, doing what I'm supposed to do, so when the time comes, I can take advantage of that opportunity. That's the war. The war is overcoming being lazy. War is overcoming the temptations of wanting to go and hang with my friends. You know, the temptations that life comes at, that life brings at you, that's a war. Anything that you struggle against, anything that you want to do, but you know if you don't do it, it can help you to be a better person in one area that you're trying to be. For me, it was giving up everything that I love, including moving to Los Angeles at the age of 18 with no money, not knowing nobody, but my war was to have a better life. Not that I knew where I was going or what I was going to do other than fight, but again, it's by faith that we're delivered. Faith is the substance of things not seen. Hoped for but not seen, rather, I'm sorry. But the point I'm trying to make, man, is I'm just trying to be the best me in a light where I'm hoping that I'm honoring my parents, I'm honoring my friends, I'm honoring even my enemies, I'm honoring everybody who has something good and or bad to say about me. I'm trying to be that dude, man, because time doesn't stand still for anybody. My oldest daughter is now she's 27, and it's like I still remember her in my arms, I mean, as a baby. But if I would have just waited until she was old enough so that then I could go and train to try to become a boxer, it never would have happened. So what I try to do, man, is be that example of a person who has the drive to try to be successful and try to help people along the way, because, you know me, I'm a man of God. And God say, I'll put it like this. He said at the end of the day, every man is going to be judged according to his deed. Your deed is what you do in life, how you think, how you feel, how you treat others. And so all I try to do is treat people the way I want to be treated and try to make the best out of every single situation, because nobody is promised tomorrow. We only got right now. So we ain't got time to be judging nobody for the way they look, their skin complexion, their financial status. You know, you judge a tree by the fruit that it bears. I mean, you could see a big tree, but if it doesn't produce anything, then it's worthless. But then you could see an ugly tree that makes the best fruit. So I judge everybody according to what they bring about into my life, give or take, you know. So that's all I try to do, man. And I just really want people to stop being afraid to live. And when I say live, I mean people always want to take this safe road, man. I didn't want to be a fan. I wanted to be a champion. So instead of sitting in the seats, I got my butt up there, and I stepped in there. I swallowed my courage, my heart, or whatever I had to do, but I got in there, and I did the best I could, man. And it's not just boxing as it applies. It's to anything in life, man. It's like you just got to take that leap, but you can't be afraid to fail. And the reason why this world is the way it is because we got a whole bunch of people that ain't walk the walk trying to tell everybody through their mouth how we should be as a people. But, you know, I ain't from Texas, but I guess, you know, I'm from the show me state. Like, don't talk about it, be about it. Don't tell me you're going to be a champion. Let me see you running around the park. Let me see you in the gym, first one in the gym, last one to leave. That's what I did, and I became heavyweight champion of the world. So if I can do it, and I put my pants on one leg at a time just like everybody else, that means everybody else can do it if they have the drive, if they have the determination. And it's not about being a champion in boxing. It's just about being a champion in life and whatever it is that you do. If it's folding paper, be the best at it, man. Second place is first loser. You know what I mean? And I don't like losing. I like being number one or whatever it is, you know. So that's all, man. We just need more people. From the time when we were growing up, it was a survival of the fittest, man. The strongest one. But today it's, oh, the government says everybody got to get a chance, and that's why this country is like we got all these effeminate men. Metrosexual men ain't no men. You know what I mean? You got, I know women of them or got more heart than some of these men today. And that's just because they've been babied, man. Society ain't used to, it ain't the society that we used to where the fence was separated. Either you was manning up or you wasn't. Nah, you ain't going to get another chance. And if you think you got another chance, you've already lost. And so I am just trying to be that example, man. And like I said, knowledge makes a man unfit to be a slave. So my mind is never going to be in a box again, ever, in terms of people telling me what I can and cannot do. You know what I mean? Because the same people told me I couldn't do it. When I did do it, they were, oh, man, yeah, I knew you could do it. Hey, can I borrow some money? You know what I mean? So that's where I'm at, man.
Hey, I definitely hear you. It's funny. You know, our men's goals change sometimes as they do, but, you know, everybody wants to be committed until it comes time, like they say, to put, you know, your life with that blood, sweat, and tears on the line. So, you know, my hat's off to you, brother, for not only talking the talk, but walking the walk. Good to spend another Sunday evening with you, my man. Pat, good friend, we went through Vietnam together, not in the same unit, but at the same time. We've been good friends since Pachanga, right around the time I met Emmanuel. So him and Jack, both have been very good to the show. Appreciate the time that they give to the show. So, Layman, make sure you give everybody your social media. And tell everyone how they will give us your final thoughts. And then you can give us your social media.
Well, okay, man. So my name is Relentless Layman Brewster, in case you don't know. I'm a former heavyweight champion of the world. I had the world title from 2004 to 2006. I knocked out Vladimir Klitschko to win the WBO title. I came back in the next year, 2005. I knocked out Andrew Gullotta, breaking the world record for the fastest knockout in the heavyweight championship title in history. And since then, I have retired due to an eye injury. But again, a setback is a setup. And what I'm doing now outside of the ring is trying to help retired fighters to be able to make a living, because people don't understand, once you retire, you still want to be thought of. You still want people to know who you are. So I try to do the best I can to try to help out boxing, man, in every way that I can, to try to make the sport better, because it's a thing to save my life. I appreciate everybody that supported boxing, that still support boxing, and I pray that they will continue to support this boxing. This ain't nothing but another fight, man. What we're going through right now in this coronavirus, this is just another fight. This ain't nothing new to a fighter. We used to fighting. So we're not going to let this get us down, man. We're going to do what we always do. We go into the late rounds, man. This is where we see what you really made of. And so I just say to all you fighters out there, man, please be safe, be smart, and the fans, keep supporting boxing, man, because boxing has saved a lot of people's lives. Boxing has kept crying down. Boxing has given a coward the energy and the confidence that he needs to be able to face his fears. And boxing has humbled guys that have been bullies, you know, by being humbled. So, you know, continue to support this sport, please. This is just another round, and we're going to get through this one way or another. You know, it's like we can't work and make it. We fight and take it, as we say. And so you can always follow me at Layman Brewster on Yahoo, Instagram, Twitter. And, you know, like I always say, I'm a real dude. I keep it real. I'm not fake. I don't do fake. I'm always here, JK, to answer any questions you guys got, man. So thank you again for allowing me always to come on your show, baby. God bless you, man. God bless the people. Hey, man, we warriors, and we got to do what warriors do, especially when it requires a time like this, when it requires for a warrior to be strong, which means being smart.
Hey, appreciate you, brother. You have a great week. Hope to talk to you next week.
Thank you, brother.
And for all our fans, don't forget to catch us Tuesday on the Dog Pound with K9. This week we're going to have Bernie Bechamel is going to be on along with Chop Chop Corley. And I'm looking to add another guest before Tuesday. So have a great weekend, everyone. Be safe. Maintain your social distancing. And as Layman said, this too shall pass. Have a great week. Yeah.